Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Masonic Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you with us again this week. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a couple of weeks. I've been working under duress here. I've had I run this, of course, through computer. That hard drive has gone for a burden, as they would say over in Britain. It's under repair, so I'm under duress working from a laptop, doing the best we can, so we'll try to pull this together a little bit. Wine, I know. Interesting, I thought an interesting episode this week, of course, needing your advice one more time, and from the enormous support that the program has had since December 2010. I don't think I'm ever going to be at a loss for the advice of from the likes of all of you fellows. So thank you very much. I'm very enormously humbled, and maybe it speaks well to the content of the material that, you know, maybe I do somehow manage to pay attention when we're talking and listening. And I wanted to, of course, wanted to talk a little bit today about some things that have been troubling me. Before I get into that, of course, I have to tell you that I'm once again stimulating the medical community here in Ontario, a fine bunch of men and women. And so if I happen to lose my breath a little bit, do not call 911. Just let me flop around on the ground for a while, I'll eventually stop. And you can go about your business. Hey, what the hell? It's an age thing. It's not that troubling anymore. Weird little world we live in, eh? All the brokers of piety and forthrightness seem to have a little bit of a dodginess about them. Skeletons in the closet. It speaks one more time to the Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher, explained so many years ago about the about human nature, and I can't think that it's lost its value today just because this is a fellow that was born in 1588, and he died on the 4th of December, 1679. The importance here, I think, for the likes of you and I, I am assuming that I'm with Masons and with friends, perhaps like-minded, but at least open, you don't have to be open-minded. Be who you are, what you are. But maybe some of this will have a bit of a bearing on you. Hobbes was a champion of absolutism for the sovereign. He also believed, he developed some of the fundamentals of European liberal thought, the right of the individual. Now, this is where things get interesting, eh? The right of the individual, the natural equality of all men, and the artificial character of the political order, which led to, sort of a later distinction between the civil society and the state. So you and I live in a civil society, and the state is something else. The view that all legitimate political power must be representative and based on the consent of the people. For me, this is, I'm thinking, it sort of burns into my mind the idea of the Republic of France, the liberty above all. And I certainly subscribe to this, this type of, and I think any rightful thinking fellow with my background would certainly give this a serious audience. So accountability and consent of the people and a liberal interpretation of the law that leaves people free to do whatever the law does not explicitly forbid. So this is the counterpoint to, I guess, totalitarianism, where somebody is telling me how to live my life. Echoes of my grandfather, Cyril, again. An honest man doesn't need laws to tell him how to live. A rightful man. But this is a fellow that, remember, one day I'll talk to you about why here and how he never referred to people as liars. He referred to them as hypocrites. Anyway, men there are, the world has hypocrites in them. Is it hypocritical of what's going on with the sort of the nation states that are so-called our protectors, that they're ruthlessly undermining the trust between them and other nations, and glibly saying, well, everybody does it. Well, everybody doesn't do it. I'm not doing it. I'm not snooping in places. If I say, if I'm being forthright with you, I'm not snooping behind your back or undermining. And they are. And they're doing some nasty things. And I tire of this notion of the rabble-rousing, repeatedly trying to instill a sense that we're in peril so that we can go and attack somebody. I'm not foolish. I think we have to be thoughtful. In our thoughtfulness, though, we have to also balance out the fact that we're being manipulated, that accountability is perhaps is a theory, but is it really factual? Is it being applied? Well, it's being applied when we find out about it. And we force, when we enforce, not force, we don't really, the issue that what Hobbes is telling us, I guess, is for me that we have the moral high ground here. I guess it doesn't happen when you've got somebody's boot on your neck and somebody that thinks that, you know, a command structure is all that's needed to be, to live a rightful existence. Well, get over yourself. That's never going to happen. Never going to happen. Around this time, around the time of Hobbes, was a fellow was born in the French nation. His name was René Descartes. And he was born in March 31st of 1596. And he was a mathematician and a writer. But he spent a lot of his time in the Dutch Republic, of course. There's a lot of things going on there. He's been talked about as the father of modern philosophy, as compared to the ancient Aristotle, Plato, and really this begins to influence what's been spoken about as Western philosophy. I don't think they have little checkered lines that separate one form of philosophy from another. I think it's more a distillation, I guess, but. Descartes frequently sets his views apart from those of his predecessors. He wrote a piece called The Passions of the Soul, and in it he's explaining something that's now commonly called emotions. He goes so far as to say that he will write on this topic as if no one had written on these matters before. And he rejects the analysis of corporeal substance into matter and form. Rejects his major idea in what was known as rationalism, and his best known philosophical statement is "I think, therefore I am." So he's starting to see a separation between between what the notions of being, dualism. You know, that the soul and the human body are separate. You know, he's suggesting, you know, otherwise, you know, he's thinking, is the body just a machine? You know, just has certain processes. Again, this fits into the sort of the machinery of our creator. My creator is Santa Claus. He gives me things. Well, I don't know if that's what I want to be leaving in my last moments, trying to convince myself that, you know, there's this big notion of me earning and negotiating, and you know, I don't know if the creator is exactly at that point of negotiating with the likes of me. But Descartes was an ethicist, and you know, let's say that he was the perfectionist, and he argues for the existence of God, and investigates the place of man in nature, and he formulates the theory of mind-body dualism, and thank goodness he defends free will, just as you heard Hobbes doing the same. So. Humans should seek the sovereign good that Descartes identifies with virtue. You know, it's interesting that we have. I suggest I'm not going to get into a whole lot of a discussion about Descartes and Hobbes, but compare those writings, take them in their time. You know, that was 16th century. Today we live in the 21st century. So are the rules a little different today? Does that mean the rules are that we haven't really developed a higher standard to based on what we've gone through, that we still are trying to be devious and subjectively rationalizing and explaining? As long as we can explain to ourselves the benefit of what we're doing, we can operate without a without a without ethics or between ethics? Is it all about what we can get away with? The shill, the illusion, the pantomime of what we show publicly and what we hold privately? Well, the great thinkers were telling us that mankind was more than that. Mankind, you and I. For me, I like the way that this material was brought forward by a guy named Benedict de Spinoza. He was a Dutchman. He was 17th century. He was born in 1632, and he's one of these guys that, you know, they pushed him in front of the bus when he was alive. You know, pushed him in front of the truck, and if you've had that happen to you, you know how wonderful it feels and what it feels like when you stand up and you realize what's happened. Sort of a bit of an honor or prestige when you realize that somebody thought that much of you to actually make a difference, eh? In the universe, anything that happens comes from the essential nature of objects or of God or nature. And according to Spinoza, reality is perfection. If circumstances are seen as unfortunate, it is only because of our inadequate conception of reality. You know that idea that we've talked about on the program before, that even within the molecules there's that positive and negatives, you know, that dynamic tension that's necessary and this constant movement that occurs. Everything is in motion around us. Perception aside. Perception being familiarity. So we don't begin to notice. It's like the idea that we were discovering that people that can't see are still able to perceive light. Now, how is that? It's just that we're now looking and measuring things that we didn't look for and measure before. Spinoza asserted that sense perception though practical and useful for rhetoric, is inadequate in discovering universal truths. We have to think. Spinoza's mathematical and logical approach to metaphysics and therefore ethics concluded that emotion is formed from inadequate understanding. For us to understand and then rise above being limited by our emotion. Do we want to think that we're a little bit more than every whim, every frown, every dissatisfaction that happens to us? That's it. You're a victim, you're subject, you're plagued by your emotion. So what are we, teenagers? Doing things impulsively with little to regard or thought? It's a bit embarrassing. The other side of it is we're so far from perfection. Don't flatter ourselves by thinking that achieving enlightenment is beyond our grasp. Or ask yourself, what in the world are you doing? You know, how is this order going to serve you if that's your belief? He gave this concept term called conatus, and it states that human beings' natural inclination is to strive toward preserving an essential being, and an assertion that virtue and human power is defined by success in this preservation of being by the guidance of reason of one's central ethical doctrine. According to Spinoza, the highest virtue is the intellectual love or knowledge of God or the universe or nature. That's the highest virtue. If I do a reread or go back in our history of the order and do a read about faith, hope, and charity, I find that charity, in the meaning of the term in the day, really didn't have to do with handouts, with dealing with somebody's sense of poverty and trying the redistribution of wealth. It didn't. Go and take a look. It has to do with connection. Good and evil have absolutely no meaning to Spinoza. The world as it exists looks imperfect only because of our limited perception. It's interesting, eh? I think the holy, and here's a little sort of catch-up line out of the first constitution. And the holy royal arch completes the fourth degree. And that's a wink-wink nudge to all of the... to all of us that can read a few lines about masonry and the connection with the Holy Royal Arch. Anthony Sayer, or maybe it was just Dr. James Anderson who left us with that gem in the first constitution, Anthony Sayer being the first Grand Master. Easier to ignore that resolve, this short phrase provides a reminder. It's easier. It really is easier to ignore it because when you see, we begin to take a look at it, which I think we probably should, we begin to wonder what was being said to us. We may not need to understand in order to know something. You know, that's happened to you, I'm sure. And now instead of sort of saying that's silliness, well, we know there's a little more going on in our brains than we ever acknowledged before. So let's pull back the ego a bit and think there's a point to that. From this point, like so many curiosities of life, a lot depends on a man's intellectual ability and desire for knowledge, determining how to resolve this type of question. You don't have to. Nothing about the order is have to. You can fluff it all away. And men do. But we don't know what goes on in the recesses of their thinking, do we? We don't. Maybe it is that casualness that makes a difference in the person's life in terms of the way they redefine themselves. So I want to ask you, are you the same as you used to be? You're the same man you once were. I'm not. I've changed. Experience. Pressure. Responsibility. Never really sure what the word maturity means. But I think it means all of that. The way I think about things is different. More today in an honest sense of amazement than with that sense of knowing, that's, you know, that sense of certainty. Might have less of that. Oh yeah, I live, like I've often said, and I don't mean to be glib about it, I live, my existence is in a world of experts. I never much claim that I know more than the next guy, and I know there's a philosophical bent toward that. You can find the philosopher that said that. But yeah, it goes back, but it certainly applies to my life. For all the right, for everybody that tells me how they're right, they seem to have a partial understanding of what's going on around us. They're partial. And I'm thinking, well, if I'm a betting man, I'm not likely to bet on that nag. It has three legs, and the person's pretty sure it's going to win. I like to see the fourth. So it's like a curiosity, though, when you think the Holy Royal Arch. This isn't, I think, about the constitution of a group of men. I think this is about a thought process. And it's illustrating to us, like all things philosophical, a type of thinking and a way of understanding. And there's different ways to use our thinking to understand. And then once we learn to grasp those ideas, it gives us something, it produces something very interesting. It produces an opinion. And we can still ask the basic and essential questions. What is right? What is best? What is ethical? Knowing those things. And really, is it any different or is it any better off than the person that gives no thought and simply sees the world in terms of right and wrong? Well, the black and white thinkers seem to have taken us down some pretty rocky paths in the past. Repeatedly. Because it brings us to a point of intolerance that humans don't seem to be able to treasure or absorb or tolerate. Black and white generally are not in motion, they're in confrontation. My stick's bigger than your stick, or as a friend explained just recently, you know, you're waving handbags at each other. Just keep slapping handbags. Where is it getting you? Get a bigger handbag? Yeah. We know where that goes. Does it mean that we start to define ourselves as the most psychotic? We're willing to cause the most damage to prevail? Interesting ethic. But our curiosity drives us, like so many things in life. A lot depends on a man's intellectual ability and desire for knowledge. Whether you're going to probe the difference between, you know, the differences, the different dimensions, the different ways of thinking, to be able to look at the world through the eyes of another person, any person. If you pick up the challenge, it'll be your enemy. How does a soldier embrace the philosophy of the Jainists, or Jainists, it might be, you know, cause no harm to anything living, human, animal, plant? How is that? And yet it happens. Even imperfectly, it happens. Has the soldier changed? Has he seen the futility? Or does he know something that he's unable to share because of the experience? Well, I think the difference of whether a person prevails or not does have something to do with intellectual ability and desire for knowledge. Because those are things that are important for us to achieve a sense of meaning. The craft, the order, helps us to achieve that. From baby steps, right on through to the florid ethics and metaphysics of the order. It's all contained. It's all within that framework of Freemasonry. Ignorance is bliss when wisdom is folly. There you go. The company we keep, I think that speaks to, in my mind, the company we keep. You want to not press yourself too much? Well, be with a crowd of fools. You know, be with people that see the world in its simplest terms, not because they've given it a great deal of thought, but because they're simply making a simplistic assumption based on the fact that they have little ability, or they demonstrate little ability. I don't know that they have little, but they don't show much. I can't tell. So, you know where it's risky to be actually thinking your way through things? Or what some people, some really thoughtful people have recently said, one fellow said, you know, you overthink things. I thought that was amazing. That's amazing. I guess what I heard was, compared to the way I approach things, you overthink things. It was just that little phrase was left out. You overthink things, really? I never think so. I think it's kind of lazy. Continental drift provided the Scottish Rite. I want to talk, you know, why do you notice that the Holy Royal Arch, the York Rite, seems to be operating in the shadows in a way, particularly when I compare it to the Scottish Rite. And I think that you know, the one, I think, is that one reason for that. I'm going to talk to you about reasons here, is that the Holy Royal Arch was infused with the first degrees, Now, that thinking came from a point where there were no degrees. Remember, in the day, there were no degrees. And all of this needed to be, yes, truly standardized so that Dale couldn't, you know, Graham couldn't come up with his own version and just say, well, here's a degree, and I'll make it a bit of flourish, and I'll teach you, and that's masonry. Well, how do you, in the world do you control, you know, how do you make any, you know, sense out of that type of thing? Everybody doesn't, and that's what was happening, you know. People were just making things up, not based on, you know, some historical or philosophical connection. So we needed to, I think I can understand the need for some, in order to be able to measure things, I want to measure the value of something, I need to have some tools, some standard measurements. And then I can go about measuring whether this, you know, how much more, how much less. And these were tools. So the Holy Royal Arch was there. Then we know that there was this French intrusion from the of the Orient, Scottish Rite, I could say, and that really took gained traction in North America. And isn't it just, you know, geographically, politically, and socially connected to think that in the day of the frontier, there was a desire to make things, to create the perception that things were better here than they were there. And to be novel. You know, you think about it, things around us were novel. Things in North America were novel because it was frontier. And we didn't have the old, you know, we didn't have Roman roads thousands of years old to walk through. We didn't have the history. We didn't have the depth of culture. We didn't have the monarchy that helped define us and frame us and give some permanence to, you know, to our existence. Across the water, the Holy Royal Arch was given its foundation in Britain and exists with some degree of importance to this day. Not to say it's of less importance, but it's really, I think, waiting here in North America to develop its rightful place. And I say rightful knowing that from the point of view of a historic Masonic connection. Meanwhile, the Scottish Rite was, I think, less encumbered because it needed a ritual, and we needed something, some form of Masonic expression that was definably North American. And the pioneer spirit, I don't think, stopped at the door of the lodge. And that entrepreneurial, developing, challenging frontiersman, ready to accept, to live in areas where laws and justice and symbols of culture were still emerging. Schools had to be built. Churches had to be built. Justice, judges, law had to be established. The rule of law had to be established. Constitution had to be established. organization on a geographic level, state to state, amongst states, the development of a nation, the control and governance of a nation. All of these things weren't givens, they were questions. And so they're very, very large tasks. And I think that we can see that Masonry moved along with the development of peoples. But I think it had a lot to do with the individual experience. Now, to think so only that Masonry came here through the military, I think is very, very curious. And I've heard that said before, but sorry, I'm not really buying it entirely. You know about inheritance in the day. So if I was the oldest son, I would traditionally inherit the estate. And if I was the second son, traditionally, I would enter the clergy. I'd be well educated. I'd have an impact in my community. I'd have a role. The third son, being relatively at loose ends, would enter the military. Now, if you were looking for what to do to distinguish yourself in the military, well, you go where the action is. But it didn't necessarily mean that you were jumping up and down and feeling good about it. It was tough. It was hard. And it meant a tremendous sacrifice. You're giving up a lot. You're giving up the familiarity of the foods and that you grew up with and the land and the communities around you, a way of thinking around you. And you were giving all of that up for a struggle in a land for reasons that may not always have made sense, but because of duty, of course. Now, is it just the military that brought Freemasonry here, or, as I suspect, it was a need by inside these men to stay connected as much as they possibly could with their roots? I don't find that offensive. In a way, I find it endearing. In a way, it speaks about the loneliness and isolation. Well, I can actually bring something very noble from the land where I was born. And I don't have to reinvent it. It's something with a degree of permanence and predictability. The relationships. And the connections, of course. And would that have been lost to all of the officers? No, of course they would have had, whether they were Masons or not, they would have had a sense of the impact of Masonry in their communities, the role. And part of that, I think, is about the connection with some of the more important estates. Aristocracy, scientists and philosophers and writers. So what today I like to think is the movers and shakers. So that would have made me want to connect and stay connected. And I think coincidental to all of that was the fact that I was here because I would be a soldier. But I wasn't like a soldier cleansed of any of my history. It was, I came here for whatever reason. Maybe I was the third son, as many were, looking for some merit that I could take back to my family in my retirement after doing a term of duty. But I think about the limitation of General Brock. He wasn't a Mason, was he? No. But he was a man of duty. Something that I tremendously respect. We know from his personal writings that he really wasn't very happy about being here. In fact, he had tremendous longings. He's homesick in a way. But he did his duty, first and foremost. His duty to his men. That was his role. That type of honorable conduct distinguishes him. Oh, yes, of course, I wish he was a Mason. But you see the value of that Masonic value that we hold dear? It had nothing to do with Masonry. It had to do with a good man. Makes good men better? I think it takes a good man to make a good Mason. But what do I know? Continental drift, eh? Makes sense that the Scottish Rite took traction here, grew here because of the newness. The opportunity was wide open. New political, social, and cultural needs in North America. Just enough of Europe to be authentic. No. You want to authenticate what you're doing. Articulated in North America by North Americans. The new breed. Huh? Capitular Masonry is significant in Britain to a greater extent than across North America. Is it then reasonable to speculate that Scottish Rite has become an ersatz Masonic body without the distraction of Royal Arch Masonry because of the 3,000 miles of Atlantic Ocean separating and isolating? Is that feasible? I like to think so. Makes sense to me. And then what? And then what? Now, I've been reading about the life of Albert Pike, and I guess in my reductionist thinking, all things about the Scottish Rite are, I've actually heard some people say that it came along first, like prominence matters. I think it's really interesting. Like what? That's like saying, well, what continent was here first? Or was everybody popping up everywhere with the same cultural depth all at the same time? Well, no. It doesn't matter. Truly, it doesn't matter. It's silly. Mine's older. Mine's bigger. Mine's heavier. Mine's stronger. It doesn't really matter. What's it saying to us? Here in Canada, here in Upper Canada, I think we're in the sweet spot. We're in the sweet spot. We're wedged between things North American to the south of us and things European to the east of us. The best. The best. And I've talked, and I think this is where the evolution of the craft. I'll act surprised if you attend in London in a couple of weeks. Act surprised. But I think this is where the evolution of Freemasonry is most interesting. We're getting around to some tasks now in our own sequence. We had other things to do on a smaller scale than our southern brethren. They're, what, 10 times bigger than us? We have had our own very unique history. The plurality here in North America, right, is different here in Canada, French and English, we're proud to say. And the way we've handled Native peoples, although, you know, we've let the lawyers and politicians, perhaps the politicians, we've politicized the process of dealing with First Nations a little more than we needed to, and it's unproductive, but that'll be settled. I'm confident. It needs to be. But now our infrastructure has come and is changing as our communities have come and changed. The means of production is changing. I don't shed a tear because it always has. It always has. There is always opportunity. Always. Always has been. Always will. Some of it, if you're a Welshman or a Scot or an Irishman, you know it's been difficult. If you're a Huguenot, you know the difficulty of the end of the Edict of Nantes. By who was it? The French king that forced so many Protestants out of France. But opportunity occurred. That's where Jean de Saulnier, his family moved to Britain, and Jean de Saulnier, of course, was the third Grand Master or second Grand Master of Grand Lodge, and notable in terms of the way that he assisted in the development of Freemasonry and his participation in the Royal Society and his participation in friendship with James Anderson. You've got to know that there was tinkering with that first constitution. So things happen for reasons that we don't necessarily always predict. But we pick up the pieces and we have to innovate. So today, we're on the verge, I think, of something that we've been needing and wanting for quite some time. And we're ready for it. We're ready for the emergence of the pomp and circumstance. We have this sense of humility, but it's in Freemasonry. I think the pendulum has swung a little far into self-consciousness. When you stand on the level, it's not that I step down to the level. We all step up to the level that we're striving to achieve. Step up, handle ourselves with poise, with sophistication. Yeah, when you hear that nattering in the background, a little while ago I was in a lodge where the master was particularly nervous and was fretting over making errors. But his lodge was incomplete. With this nattering, this senseless impatience, no connection. Where's the support? Where's that moment to put your hand on the fellow's shoulder and say, that's okay, we'll get through it, it's not the end of the world. And take your time. And if you do get nervous, that's understandable. But if you show your nervousness a little more than I did, that's not a crime. And for somebody to be tapping their foot and looking at their watch and huffing and puffing about how much time that it takes, well, so. Impatient little boys, eh? Unable to control their emotion. Imperfect in their understanding. Maybe Descartes was right, eh? Maybe the philosophers do speak to us. Maybe there are lessons to be learned. I certainly think we can all agree that that's not something that's going to stop anytime soon. But if you're still with me, I hope you are. I want to talk a little bit about Montaigne. I come back to talking to you about Albert Pike. I want to do that because I'm going to be hopefully of an opportunity to be talking on matters of the development and education in Scottish Rite Masonry. Very, very beautiful little vignettes, those little morality plays. But I want to get into, the context to help everybody understand the context of those little, I shouldn't say little in the diminutive sense, but those pieces that once they're woven together, they can be quite compelling. Now, let me slide into, you okay? Are you doing all right out there? Do you need a moment just to go and fill your glass? Yeah, it's okay. Go ahead and do that. Refill your glass, and I'm going to talk a bit about Montaigne here. You know, we'll continue on with the beautiful work about how to live well, and so like that curious analysis that this fellow discovered or realized about how to, you know, what the essence of living well meant. This one is around love and tyranny. How to live, the answer is to survive love and loss. Now, Montaigne was only in his mid-20s. He met this fellow and they became really close friends. And back in the day when gentlemen were writing about their relationship, compared to today, they seemed to gush. And this was before around a period of where romanticism, and I don't mean in a sexual or visceral notion, but in the intellectual sense of romanticism, was coming into play. And the highest honor, distinction of a relationship was, in a sense, to embellish the impact of a person's relationship on you or on me. So we would see these very eloquent and beautiful passages in letters talking about the desperation of being away from my friend. And this was really a spiritual and intellectual desperation. Back when men were able to speak with that kind of candor without, you know, feeling ridiculously restrained, as we often are today. Well, de Montaigne met up with a fellow named Étienne de la Boétie, B-O-E-T-I-E. And this fellow, they shared a lot of things. They were very, you know, when you find somebody that shares that sense of subtlety that you do, and likes to work, and the differences were significant, but, you know, between the fellows. But the two men, one was, you know, sort of in depth, and the other was a bit flaky or light by comparison. But they were both involved in the government of Baron Bordeaux in France. And they liked to work very hard and socialize. But the difference is they were locked into each other like pieces of a puzzle. It's an interesting metaphor, I think, because I think our order is looking for the, you know, the piece to the puzzle as we continue to explore the future. But the only way we know this fellow, La Boétie, is through Montaigne, you know, through the writings. But anyway, you know, what the importance here is that when La Boétie died, Montaigne felt he could never really move on, never got over it. The loss was so great. A huge effect on Montaigne, who felt that lingering sense of mourning all the rest of his days. Now, what do you do? The 9th of August, 1563, La Boétie had spent the day in an open air in the state of François de Perlouse d'Escar, the man who rebelled against the Bordeaux Parliament. And that evening, La Boétie was supposed to have dinner with Montaigne, but as he was about to leave d'Escar's house, he began to have, you know, stomach pains and diarrhea. And he sent a message over to his friend saying, I'm not really feeling ill. Do you mind if we just cancel? And he said, instead, you know, would you come over and see me? And Matanya, you know, he's worried about his good friend's health. And when Matanya arrived, he found his friend was in bad shape. And he had caught a chill from being outside, and he really wasn't looking very well. And there was in the area threat of the plague. Yep, that one. So Montaigne immediately advised him, said, let's move out of here and go to some area less infected so there's less chance. And he took him to stay with his own sister and brother-in-law. And in La Plata, didn't even feel well enough to travel. And it seems like he already had the plague. So Montaigne left the next morning, and Laboite's wife sent for him, saying that her husband was getting worse. And he sent a request and spent the night there. He asked me for more affection and insistence than ever about anything else, to be with him as much as I could. And this touched me considerably. In other words, do I matter? Do you care? On Saturday, he admitted that his illness was contagious and unpleasant, and a hint that he now realized it was the plague. So between Monday and Saturday, he declined. And on Sunday, he was overcome, and he was feeling really weak and beginning to hallucinate. And Montaigne reassured him. Death has nothing worse about it than that, my brother. To which Laboite replied that indeed, nothing could be worse than that. At that point, he admitted that he had lost hope. So he decided he needed to make sure his affairs were in order, and he asked his friend Montaigne just to keep an eye on his wife and uncle in case grief got the better of them. And then they composed their faces, you know, got themselves straightened away. And they called the priest, and Laboite collected himself so carefully for his deathbed speeches that Montaigne felt a moment of hope. But once the effort was over, his friend deteriorated again. A few hours later, Montaigne told him that he blushed with shame, for shame, to see him showing more courage in the face of his own death than he, Montaigne, was able to find in witnessing it. Funny the way we redefine courage. Isn't it? Redefine bravery. I had been prepared for it for a very long time and had known my lesson all by heart. He had followed the ancient's advice and rehearsed his death as well. After all, he went on, still echoing the wisdom of the sages, he had lived healthily and happily for long enough. There were no need for regrets. Had he not already made it to a good age? I was soon to be 33. God granted me this grace that all my life up to now had been full of health and happiness. In view of the inconsistency of human things, that could hardly last any longer. Old age would only have brought him pain and might have made him miserly. It was better to have avoided this. Montaigne looked quite distressed, and Laboite reminded him that he must be strong. What, my brother, do you want to put fear into me? If I felt fear, would but you should take it away from me? Laboite was dying the perfect stoic death, full of courage and rational wisdom. Montaigne was expected to do his part to help his friend to maintain his courage, and then to act as witness, recording the details so others could learn from the story. Perhaps in so doing, he improved on reality slightly to make Boite sound nobler and braver than he was. Perhaps not. Laboite's sense of the classical virtues went so deep that he may genuinely have been capable of emulating his philosophical heroes almost to the end. As Montaigne wrote of him, his mind was modeled in the pattern of other ages than this. The next morning, Laboite slipped in and out of consciousness. And they revived him in the day with vinegar and wine. And he said to his friend, "Don't you see that from now on all the help you give me serves only to prolong my pain?" "My Lord," he said, "who is tormenting me so? Why do you take me out of this great pleasant rest that I'm in? Leave me alone, I beg you." Over the next hours, he called out for Montaigne simply to know whether I was near. Montaigne was willing to try any trick of the kind, if it promised consolation. So he wrote in one of his dedications to Le Poitier's posthumous books, "He is still lodged in me so entire and so alive that I cannot believe that he is so irrevocably buried or so totally removed from our communication." Letting Le Poitier live on within himself was a way of fulfilling his friend's dying wish and easing his own loneliness. Meanwhile, he used techniques of distraction and diversion to get himself through the immediate shock of loss. Best of all, he discovered the therapeutic benefits of writing. By passing on Le Poitier's death narrative and farewell to the world in written form, he helped himself to relive the scene and thus outlive it. He never fully got over Le Poitier, but he learned to exist in the world without him, and in so doing, to change his own life. Writing about Le Poitier eventually led him to write the essays, the best philosophical trick of all. And that's the material that I share with you each and every week. Now, how are we doing? Okay so far? Hope so. I'm just going to tear into a little bit here for you, and then you okay with something a little more esoteric? Do you mind? I know. I don't mean to be that glum and that serious, but sometimes it just seems fitting or right to talk about things a little bit more in depth. So if the time is right for you, this show will feel all right, feel good. If the time is not right, turn it off. Here, let me read to you. You know, let me get into a little bit. This is from a bit of work that was. This was done. This is printed in Cincinnati in 1897. It's called "The Symbols of Freemasonry" or "The Greater Mysteries of Antiquity," and it was done by J.D. Buck. And he said, "Here's what you know. You gotta like this." The late Albert Pike in Morals and Dogma. Again, now I'm finding maybe Al didn't write Morals and Dogma. Maybe. At least the personal papers about this fellow don't support that. Anyway, a few rudimentary lessons in architecture, says Pike. A few universally admitted maxims of morality. A few unimportant traditions whose real meaning is unknown or misunderstood will no longer satisfy the earnest inquirer after Masonic truth. You buy that? Give us something a little more? Sort of get to that point and say, well, that's it. That's all we got. That's there's nothing more here. See if we can... I'm just plugging away here. I guess I think we're not doing too badly on a laptop. That means it could go really portable. Poor Montaigne. It brings back a line from my friend David's poems that he really resonates with. He's a very refined man. If you can keep your head, it's called "If." If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself. If you can trust yourself when all about you doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies or being hated. Don't give way to hating. And don't always look too good nor talk too wise. Mm-hmm. Well, for a boy from Prince Edward Island, that's never going to happen. Who were only a heartbeat from a plaid shirt and a pair of rubber boots. Nothing, strike the pose. You want to look your best and brightest? And those rubber boots better not be too new either. Get over yourself, you silly buggers. You can't laugh at yourself. You're buggered. You're going nowhere and you're not that good at what you're doing. Oh, did I say that thought out loud? Shit, sorry. I take that back. Of course not. There we go. As long as the struggle for bare existence evolves as it is today, the greater part of the energy, time, and opportunities of man, he will never discover the real meaning of manhood or the purpose of human existence. Even this much may be discerned from physical evolution alone, from the study of the human brain, in which there is continually an increasing portion of gray cells set free from the functions incident to the preservation of the physical structure, and evidently designed to be appropriated to separate and higher uses. Now, this man is talking about the difference between the brain and the mind. Well, 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 well. Fancy that. Uppity young bugger here, isn't he? Yeah. So remember, I'm in a weakened state here, and I'm with you. I'm with you lot, and you know what that brings out. We have some interesting conversations, don't we? Mere intellectual activities alone, connected with the physical plane, with the maintenance and enjoyment of life, will not explain the philosophy of cerebral development. It is largely for this reason that the offices of the encephalon are so little known today. It's part of the brain. Now remember, we're getting into, this is called mystic masonry. Okay? Mystic masonry. From the 1896, Victoria was still alive when this was printed. There are latent powers and almost infinite capabilities in man. Does that mean we all have, you know, so that's like saying the latent powers, is something that's just sitting there. Is that dormant, the same as dormancy? And does that mean we all have this ability to step forward and be contemplative? Maybe that's my conceit, that I think that I see that, I look for that. And maybe that's my conceit because it's part of my, is that my temperament or my personality? And so I want to see that and want to make those connections with other people. But try and try as I can. I keep thinking that Freemasonry speaks like that to all of us. So like step back and think. Step back and practice. And accept the supervision. Accept the, and I of course, the mentoring, where the master sees the potential for the inner apprentice and understands how to encourage the man without discouraging the ego, without discouraging the drive to succeed. Because the task is difficult, so we always want to leave the fellow feeling that he can do it. Not that he's been browbeaten by somebody that thinks they know, have all the answers and is a poor teacher. We may have good answers, but that doesn't mean we can teach. And for the young fellows, you know, for young and old, who think that criticism is a way of teaching. Really? What, do you just make that up? Spin that out your arse, as they would say? Criticism is what starts the conversation. And then we put everything together. Ah, somebody's ringing in to yell at me. It's largely for this reason that the offices of the encephalon are so little known today. Nor will leisure and intellectual cultivation alone reveal these powers. It's only through a complete philosophy of the entire nature of man and the capacities and destiny of the human soul implemented for the use of such knowledge that man will eventually come to the possession of his birthright. And from this general infancy, as Browning puts it, begin the journey from real manhood to perfection. Yes, that Browning. Two conditions at the present time stand squarely in the way of these achievements. First are anarchy and confusion. Now stay with me. Put down your torch, crazy buggers. The result of selfishness in all social relations. That's anarchy and confusion. And they occur because of selfishness. This condition can be overcome in but one way, by the recognition of the unqualified brotherhood of man, not as a theory, a religious duty, or a mere matter of sentiment, but as a fact of nature, a universal and divine law, the penalty for the violation of which is precisely the conditions under which humanity now suffers. I'm going to wrap this up soon. I'm just going to give you the second condition, which has given rise to the confusion among the workmen in building the social temple and the individual habituation of man, is false ideas, inefficient methods of education, and almost total ignorance of the existence and the nature of the soul. Mind, body, and spirit. Wasn't that what the Greeks taught us was necessary? Preserve the mind, strengthen the mind, preserve and strengthen the body, exercise. Now, this other question about the preservation and strengthening of the spirit. The result of this ignorance may be seen in the fact that not one individual in a million who has both leisure and opportunity makes any real advance in the evolution of the higher powers, or is even cognizant of the fact that he is a living soul. Old age is filled not only with infirmities, but also with miseries without number. Not one in a million can say with the poet, 'tis the sunset of life gives me mystical lore, as coming events cast their shadows before. In the great majority of cases with the aged, the death is looked upon with uncertainty or fear, as with the blessed release from suffering and sorrow. Life is thus endured as a necessary evil and is more often voted by the individual to be a failure than a success. What life ought to be is often conceived from our many failures. What it might be is dimly perceived from the intuitions of the soul, which the struggles and selfishnesses of existence have failed to entirely obliterate. Wow, persistent, eh? Wow. Can you believe that? Take the hint, man. These things ought not to be so, nor need they longer, if earnest men and women should seek diligently first for the cause of all our ills, and secondly for a sufficient remedy. Well, I don't know about you, but these persistent telephones, you know, Masonic Companion, there is a call-in, so perhaps that's what's happening here. And I apologize. I tried to don't take calls during the program normally. So if it's happened, it's happened. But we'll come back to this another day. We'll just say, that's it. It's enough. Have we accomplished anything today? I like to think we have. I like to think we've made a connection Masonically. I hope that I've been a bit informative, a bit entertaining, and I look forward to your advice with the opinions that have been tossed out. What's your thoughts on them? Let me know next time we're together or when you're with each other. Do you share the idea, that vision, that Freemasonry is on the brink of the next epoch? We step up. Pomp and circumstance, overcoming our self-consciousness and our sense of humility. And yeah, I close my eyes and I think of that beautiful, beautiful Grand Lodge one day where we can congregate and we can look across the galleries at one another and into the Grand Lodge for the performance of ritual that is ancient, that helps to define our order as something quite distinguishable from anything else going on in the world. I look forward to seeing you all again. Make sure you come back and we'll get on with this, okay? We'll get on with this the best way that we possibly can. The best way that we possibly can, gentlemen. And in the meantime, be sure to commit random acts of kindness, Masonic kindness, and make it count. Make it count every single day. If I can figure out my little I'm just trying to, I'm messing around here. I'm trying to figure out this little music. I'm just trying to put together some music for you here. And like everything else, you can say goodbye now or listen to me try and, get around with this silly thing. It's just shouldn't be that hard, should it? Of course, I can make it anything hard. Just give me a chance. You'll see. I've got a little Chet Baker here, and it's really it's great, beautiful. So that's why I wanted to share with you. Well, it's playing somewhere. I just can't get it to play for you. So until next time, you take good care of each other, and I'll sign off. I'll see you in a couple of days. Thanks.